This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and first off, we check in with Dan Carton, who covers the State House and state politics in Indianapolis for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Dan, as always, thanks for being with us.
Always happy to be here.
Well, you've had a very, very busy year so far, and we're only about 4 months into the year already, and haven't gotten to the first election of the two. So you had a chance to file stories from the State House, and now you've got a three-day string of wins in stories here about the latest, I guess, the last debate between the three Republican candidates that want to go up against Democrat Senator Joe Donnelly this fall. Tell us first, if you will, about the debates that finished it up here, as well as the assessment that the Lugar Center has recently done about what was out there.
Yeah, so this was the final debate. It was the only debate that featured questions from Hoosier voters. The other debates had been run by the Republican Party or sort of right-wing interest groups. And the questions were good. They tried to get at some serious policy issues during the debate, but the three candidates were pretty much focused entirely on linking themselves to Donald Trump and calling their opponents a variety of names. Mm-hmm. Throughout the entire debate, it really was a Trump love fest on the one hand, and then my opponents are the worst people on earth on the other hand. So I don't know that it was necessarily particularly informative for voters, and the limited amount of public polling in the Senate race shows that there's potentially a huge pool of undecided Republicans who are trying to figure out which of these three guys they want to represent their party and take on Joe Donnelly in the fall.
I guess that's going to be the case where Republican voters, once they get to their ballot, they're going to have to sift through this, and then if they haven't thought about this ahead of time, they're going to spend some time scratching their heads trying to decide which of the three persons they'll pick.
Yeah, and two of them are kind of the same. Todd Rokita, originally from Munster, a congressman, former Secretary of State, and Luke Messer, another congressman. The third candidate at the rate, Mike Braun, the businessman and a former state representative, he's actually been carrying around these cardboard cutouts of Rokita and Messer, both wearing identical suits with red ties, trying to portray himself as the outsider. Rokita is selling himself as the fighter, and Messer is more of the sort of the establishment pick. He's got the under-the-radar support of the Pence people. Mike Pence's brother is actually running for Messer's congressional seat in central Indiana, so it remains to be seen who's gonna get the nod from the Republican voters in the state.
And we know that in the at least the past that the candidates haven't said much about other than just talking about each other and how bad the other person is, so to speak, when it comes to the issues. As you recall, what did they seem to say in this final debate here about issues like President Trump's proposal for increased tariffs overseas on steel and on aluminum, among other things?
Yeah, that's kind of what's really surprising, is sort of how far they've gone down the road with Trump. No matter what Trump says or does, they all seem to be on board. So Rokita and Messer, who in Congress voted repeatedly for free trade deals that they said at the time would help American companies place their products and sell their goods overseas, now suddenly want tariffs on foreign imports, which obviously is going to produce retaliatory tariffs on American products. And the biggest people at risk are Hoosier farmers. They export a lot of food, particularly to Asia. And if China, those countries impose tariffs on Hoosier agricultural products, that the market for those goods is going to suffer. They're going to have to try and sell them in the United States, which will drive down the prices, which will drive down their profits, which will hurt the incomes of Hoosier farmers. So it's kind of surprising to see those candidates support tariffs, but they support Trump, and Trump supports tariffs, so they're on board.
And I know that the moderator of this last debate, the one that created a bit of controversy himself, and we've talked about Abdul Hakim Shabazz, the Indianapolis political observer as well as talk show host in the capital city had brought up the question about which, you know, what they might actually do if they happen to be elected to either of them, any of them, for that matter, all three of them, had been elected to the Senate. And it seemed to be, as you say, that they pretty much said they would stick to the Trump agenda. But I guess there are probably more serious questions that they probably should have taken up, too.
Yeah. What was interesting about that was he asked three separate times to each of the candidates, what is there anything you would differ with Trump on? And none of them were willing to admit anything, which is remarkable because, you know, Trump's positions don't necessarily line up with the standard Republican positions. They don't line up with Governor Holcomb's positions, presumably the leader of the Republican Party in Indiana. Todd Rokita's out there condemning Mike Braun for voting for the governor's road funding plan. Mm-hmm. It's a little surprising to see, you know, how much they're willing, how many people and how many groups and how many fellow Republicans they're willing to throw under the bus to try and win this nomination.
We're talking with Dan Carton with the Times of Northwest Indiana about the final debate between the three Republican U.S. Senate candidates that happened in Indianapolis. What it seems to be the reaction that you managed to get from the chairman of the Indiana Democratic Party, John Zodi, about this?
Yeah, John Zodi thought the debate was a big win for Joe Donnelly. You know, Donald Trump won Indiana by 19 points in 2016. So there is a logic to why these candidates are backing Trump with no limits, particularly in a Republican primary. But at some point, one of them is going to win the primary and is going to have to pivot to a general election mindset. And you know, not everybody who votes in a midterm. It's just going to be a very different electorate in a 2018 midterm compared to a 2016 presidential election. And Joe Donnelly has done a good job of kind of keeping the Democratic base, such as it is in Indiana, mm-hmm. Intact. You know, he's reached out to the union people. He's you know, he's been doing a lot of work with veterans, and some of those Democratic crossover voters in 2016 might not be crossing over in 2018 in the Senate race. And plus, you know, going forward, you've got 6 more months after the primary for Donald Trump to, you know, potentially do something great like bring peace to the Korean Peninsula or potentially screw that up and see Seoul dissolved in a, you know, nuclear holocaust. So It's a real risk for the Republican candidate, but, you know, high risk, potentially high reward is a 6-year seat in the Senate.
One thing, too, I know in the stories that you had out here in the Times this week, talking, I guess, kind of an aftermath of the senatorial debate, was what the Lueker Center's bipartisan index had to say about the candidates as well as the incumbent, Joe Donnelly.
Yeah, it's interesting. Former U.S. Senator Dick Lueger represented Indiana for 36 years in the Senate. He's a Republican. Every year, this think tank he created after he left the Senate in 2012 measures how often members of Congress, both houses, work with members of the opposite party to sponsor legislation, or how often their legislation picks up sponsors from the other party. And what it found is that Joe Donnelly was in 2017 was the fourth most bipartisan senator. That actually was a little bit of a dip. He's been the second most bipartisan senator every year before that. But what kind of was interesting was Todd Young, who's the new Republican senator from Indiana, ended up being the ninth most bipartisan senator. He was only in the top quarter of House members when he was in the House in 2016, so he's really sort of embraced bipartisanship now that he's been in the Senate. And those two are the only state. So Indiana was the only state with two senators in the top 10 for bipartisanship. There were only two more states that had two senators in the top 20. So it really shows that for the senators Hoosiers have elected so far, they seem to want people who are willing to work across party lines to get stuff done.
Well, once we get to the taken care of, we just get to election here and decide which of the, as we've mentioned before, which of the three Republican candidates are likely to be chosen by the voters to go up against Joe Donnelly. And in November. One of the other stories that you had online as well as in print recently here was talking about some nominations for filling spots, on the Indiana Court of Appeals. And I see that we have an attorney from LaPorte County as well as a judge here in Lake County that are among the finalists. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Judge Michael Barnes currently serves on the Indiana Court of Appeals. He's stepping down on June 1st. And Indiana has what's known as a merit selection process. So lawyers and judges who want to fill the seat submit their applications to this Indiana Judicial Nominating Commission, which is led by Chief Justice Loretta Rush. Mm-hmm. And the commission reviews their applications, interviews the applicants, then does a second round of interviews, and ultimately recommends three candidates to Governor Holcomb, who will appoint one of them to the bench. So on Tuesday, the commission finished up the first round of interviews and picked 6 out of the 12 applicants to go on to a second round of interviews. That included Lake County Superior Judge Elizabeth Tavitas and Jamie Oss, who is a LaPorte attorney. Interestingly, both of them previously applied for vacancies on the Indiana Supreme Court, didn't get selected, but now have reapplied for this Court of Appeals opening, which is one level below the Supreme Court, and have a pretty good chance of advancing to the final three that the governor will pick the new judge from.
I recognize the name and Oss's name in particular when that last time that they had the vacancy on the Indiana Supreme Court, that he was one of the finalists as well. So it's nice to see that they certainly haven't given up, that they want to do their best to see if they can make it on to, I guess, the next possibility of being a portion of the top judgeship of Indiana.
Yeah, it really is a high position. There's only 15 Court of Appeals judges. There's 5 Supreme Court judges. There's one tax court judge, which is sort of a specialized appellate court. But out of the entire state, there's just these 21 positions. They don't come open that often. The Court of Appeals is divided into these kind of weird districts. So this opening is only for the northern third of the state. So somebody from the northern third of the state is going to get it, and why not somebody from Northwest Indiana?
Certainly. And also, too, if you make it onto, even if you're just a regional representative, so to speak, on the Board of Appeal or the Court of Appeals, you still get to review and hear cases from across the state. So if you're not familiar with other parts of Indiana, you certainly learn very fast what the judicial life is like in those communities as well.
Absolutely. And there's a chance to move up. Justice Rucker, who just retired from the Indiana Supreme Court, got his start on the Indiana Court of Appeals. He served there for 10 or 12 years, and when there was an opening on the Supreme Court, the governor put him up there.
That's great. Dan Carton is a state house reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, also covers political news and other news in Indianapolis as it comes up, and that's why he was down there catching the latest senatorial debate involving the three Republican Party candidates. And as always, Dan, we really appreciate you spending time with us today, and hope we'll have you back on soon, because it's going to be pretty soon we'll have to talk about a special legislative session. So I hope that we'll have you back on again soon.
Yeah, Election Day is Tuesday. Special session coming up on May 14th.
That's right. Thanks, Dan. Talk to you soon.
All right.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. With Reporters Roundtable Thursday, we'll check in with Carol Carlson, who's with the Post Tribune. And Carol, we have more stories about the election. Well, imagine that. We have an election coming up. Certainly, folks would probably in some of the races wouldn't even think about that. But in particular, it's an interesting race for a particular position that has been held by what you could definitely call a veteran lawmaker. And we are talking about the first congressional district race that is underway now on the Democratic Party side, and I guess even more the Republican Party side, too. That seems to be interesting. And you had a chance to write a good story about that. Carol, tell us about it.
Well, hi, Chris, and thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. Yes, I wrote this story about Pete Visklosky, who, in fact, is running for his 18th term. That's a long time. Pete is, of course, a Democrat, and he is challenged by 2 other Democrats in the Tuesday primary. On the Republican side, there are 6 candidates who would like to replace Visklosky in Congress.
Tell us a little bit about, in particular, we know a lot about Pete Visclosky, but I'm sure that he probably has had a chance to talk with you in more detail about going once again before the voters, asking to be reelected.
Pete, of course, is largely responsible for what is known as the Marquette Plan. That's development along the lakeshore. It resulted in improvements at Marquette Park in Gary and Wahala Beach in Whiting, as well as in Portage, the River Walk Lakeshore Park there. And he is shifted his attention now to other infrastructure needs involving the South Shore Railroad expansion along the Westlake Corridor from Hammond down to Dyer, and also the double tracking of the South Shore to improve its ability to get to Chicago quickly. That is between Gary and Michigan City. So those are what he's looking at now, as well as his continued focus on the Gary-Chicago Regional Airport, or International Airport, I'm sorry, which is about to unveil a new Customs and Border Patrol facility.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are two people running against him in the Democratic Party primary. Tell us about these folks.
Antonio Daggett is a retired colonel in the Army. He was active in the school city of Gary as far as teaching ROTC classes. He's very active in the community. Mm-hmm. I think he has 10 children, maybe 9. So he's very familiar with school kids. And the other opponent on the Democratic side is a guy named Larry Chubb, who's out of Chesterton. I believe Larry is a businessman, and he is a Bernie Sanders fan, mm-hmm. and he is kind of following the mantra of Bernie in that he's not accepting PAC money, and he's holding very progressive views.
Now, we've mentioned that there are a number of people on the Republican Party primary side looking to be able to go up against Pete Visclosky in November. Tell us about these folks, and from the people you've talked to, which person might be the one that will be luckiest enough to win the election for the Republicans?
Boy, I'll try to remember them all.
Okay.
First of all, Mark Levia, he's run about 4 times against Visclosky. Of course, lost every time. There are some issues that he focuses on involving the Constitution. He's very much into following the Constitution and issues that emanate from that. The other candidates are an attorney named Roseanne Ivanovich, and along with her, there is a veterinarian named Nicholas Pappas.
We have another attorney, too, don't we? I guess a gentleman, John Meyer, I believe, is his name, is it not?
John's the former federal prosecutor. I believe he worked in Chicago. Now he works as a private attorney, and he is focusing on reducing the national debt.
Does it seem to be that anybody in particular seems to surface, I guess, as a potential candidate? Anybody that you've talked to in your
well,
sources?
One of them will. I don't have a sense of who's getting the most traction here. Yeah. Ivanovich is the only one on the Republican side who is listed as raising campaign money. She's got close to $7,000 that she's raised. Mm-hmm. The rest of them have not raised any money. So I don't know, maybe you give her the nod?
We'll find out. That's to be sure there. Now, the other stories I know, that Carol, that you've worked on here for the Post Tribune, again, about the election coming up, are both involving Calumet Township in Lake County. And first story that I've got here to check on is the one that you did about the primary challenge that the Calumet Township trustee faces. Tell us about what Kimberly Robinson's going up against in November, or going up against in this next week, rather.
Incumbent Kim Robinson is facing a challenge from LaVita Sparks Wade. She is she's a Gary City Councilwoman. She represents the Glen Park District. And I guess I described it as a pretty testy race. Mm-hmm. Sparks Wade is hammering Robinson for a 2016 trip that she took to Aruba. The trip was described to me by Robinson as a conference to learn more about treating people of color and serving them in the community. But Sparks Wade is just calling that a junket. She said that one of Robinson's friends was along. They celebrated her birthday. Robinson, on the other hand, said that it was a worthy conference, so I guess it's up to the voters to decide. She said she came back a day early because the flights were cheaper. Mm-hmm. I think it cost about $2,400 for that trip. Oh. So that's one of the issues that she's being criticized for. The other one is that she has increased her salary by about $7,000 since she's been in office, and Robinson says that she also has eliminated about 30 or 40 positions, and because of that, she is doing more of the work herself. So she thinks that she is deserving of the raise.
And we know for sure that in Calumet Township, there is still the issue that is yet to be resolved from the town of Griffith wishing to secede from Calumet Township, and that's over the poor relief expenses that the city feels wrongfully that they're paying. They're paying too much of the share, they think, in what goes into Calumet Township coffers. And I'm sure that even though it's probably not one of these issues that's directly on the ballot, it's something we know that that Kimberly Robinson has to deal with, and I wonder if Lavetta Sparks-Wade has talked anything about that.
Yes, she has. Sparks-Wade feels that Griffith is integrally important to Calumet Township, mm-hmm. and that they have been underserved by the trustee's office. She would like to see perhaps an office located in Griffith or some way of having more feedback or input from the residents of Griffith, who provide about $1 million a year to the trustee's budget.
All right. Now we've covered the Calumet Township trustees race, per se, that's on the ballot in next week's election. Let's take a look now at the counterpart, in a way, the Calumet Township board. There aren't many members of the board, I understand. You say three, but there are an awful lot of people that are very interested in this position, especially on the Democratic Party side of the ballot. Tell us why.
There are 17 people who want to fill the three seats that are open on the Calumet Township board. The answer is simple. It's the salary. Long ago, I tried to find out when this exactly happened, but mm-hmm. as far as I could find out, it started at least two decades ago. The salary has remained at $25,000 a year, and these folks are required to attend four meetings.
Four meetings. Wow. Well,
and
just do the math.
I'm told by Jim Robinson that those meetings rarely go beyond 30 minutes. They're rarely attended by much of the public, and they're pretty routine meetings where they simply vote on contracts or the budget or other issues that don't take a lot of intense scrutiny, mm-hmm, right. and they don't get a lot of public scrutiny for what they do.
And we know that the Calumet Township Board is one of those that has kind of become the poster child for township government reform, at least as far as what the folks in Indianapolis think about it. It's been up for review a number of times before the General Assembly, and I'm sure that this is one of these cases in particular when they see this election, and how many people want to have this one of these seats, and how much money that they're going to be making for it.
Yeah, it's not just Calumet Township that has raised concern with some of the lawmakers. They're trying to get at some township reform throughout the state,
right.
and Calumet Township was part of that. And the bill that failed this past General Assembly session would have reduced their salary from $25,000 down to $5,000.
That might be perhaps a bit more palatable financially, to be sure, if you figure you're only going to meet three or four times a year. That if you're only taking $1,000 per meeting, it's better than a lot more per meeting if for the same amount of it, because you're making so much money, I suppose.
Yeah, that was, I'm sure, part of the thinking.
Well, have you had a chance to talk with anybody else here in concern to all these people that's happened to be on the ballot? I guess maybe should we ask, as we talk about the Democratic Party primary ballot, are there any people that are on the Republican side that
are
interested?
None. No Republicans signed up.
I'm sure somebody will be put on the ballot here in November to be sure about this. They'll counter the election that's happening now coming up this next week. And as always, Carol Carlson from the Post Tribune, who's been covering these stories for the newspaper online and in print. Thank you for taking time with us to talk about it today, and we hope to have you back on again soon.
Thank you, Chris.
Congressman Todd Rokita is one of three candidates hoping to emerge from the Republican Party primary next week and face Democrat incumbent Senator Joe Donnelly in November. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith has had a chance to chat with all three of the candidates. And this time we wrap up the series with Todd Rokita.
Each of the candidates have done their best to sort of align themselves with President Trump and his policies. Are you worried, though, that tying yourself to someone who personally can be fairly unpredictable puts you at any risk with the voters?
I don't think so. As I go around the state of Indiana, what happened in the fall of 16 is still true today, and that is President Trump has a lot of support. They, in fact, like his unpredictability. He is turning political correctness on its head. And, you know, I think that's for a lot of folks, including me, that's refreshing.
One of the issues that some Hoosiers have started to maybe disagree with President Trump, though, is on a potential trade war with China, particularly Hoosier farmers who are worried what it'll do to their industry. What do you say to those farmers about tying yourself to President Trump at a time when he may be doing something that's unpopular with them?
Well, of course, I visit with farmers all the time. The agricultural industry is huge in Indiana, and they know that I'm very accessible and always have been. But so is manufacturing. It's huge in Indiana. So is steel production. And whether it's the steel workers, the manufacturers, or the farmers, I think what we all have in common is that we want America strong again. And that's what I hear from farmers. I just met with a group in Lebanon, and sure, they had concerns, and I heard their concerns. And I'm going to be, as these targeted tariffs play out, I'm going to make sure that no sector, agriculture or any other one, is inequitably hurt by this. But we have got to try something different.
Maybe the signature achievement so far of the Trump administration with Congress has been the tax reform bill. Are you worried, though, that working class Hoosiers aren't seeing enough in their paychecks to compare to what we see, obviously, big corporations getting?
I think it's just the opposite. I mean, look, it's $85 on average per paycheck for every working Hoosier, and that's a lot. That's money. I mean, bonuses are $1,000 or more. That's someone's utility bill for a good part of the year. That's someone's child care. So they do mean something.
You've campaigned in the past and currently talking about deficits and the burden we're placing on future generations. Yet, analyses of that tax reform bill suggest it could significantly increase the deficit. Are those compatible?
I deal with those analyses all the time on the budget committee, and they're generally wrong. And that is because they are what we call static. Right, they don't account for the fact that the economy is going to grow as a result of this, and that tax receipts will actually grow up. So government doesn't have, especially at the federal level, a revenue problem. Government has a spending problem. So if you want to reduce deficits, if you want to reduce debt, you got to have courageous conservatives in the Senate, like me, who have a record of reducing spending, even in the Secretary of State days.
Speaking of your days as Secretary of State, something that's bubbled up in the campaign has been these charges that you improperly accessed a state party database. It's somewhat similar to what we saw with former Superintendent Tony Bennett that got
into
some hot
water. No, it's different.
Why is it different?
It's fake news. Those are anonymous sources. You can't even refute the rumors because they're anonymous, but it's false. I was the chief election officer for the state of Indiana, so I would, in part of my official duties, have to contact party chairman. I would have to contact precinct committeemen so they can hold an appointment election for a vacancy or something like that. That's what we're talking about here. It had nothing to do with donors or anything like that.
And then lastly, obviously you plan to win, but can you say right now you would support whoever the winner is against Joe Donnelly in the fall?
Well, I do plan to win, and in fact we are winning. And so I look forward to being the nominee against Joe Donnelly, and that's how we're going to get the job done.
If you're not, you'll support Messer or Braun?
Listen, the fact of the matter is Joe Donnelly has to go. He's not in line with Hoosier values, so we have got to beat Joe Donnelly, and that mission will continue for sure, to answer your question, after May 8th.
Thanks so much for sitting down with me.
Yeah, thank you.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Times' That's So Region weekly podcast has recently hosted a panel. It features reporters and staff members like Matt Schubert, Carrie Erickson, Joseph Pete, and Krista Zivanovich. And they talked about some of the top trending stories both online and in print, including anonymous racism, a reader's reaction to a Times photo, Carson's recent announcement that it'll close all three of its region stores, and ICE arresting 8 people in Highland. Here's the conversation.
let's jump right into the topics.
Also for the coffee bars.
First one, this was a story I think resonated with a lot of people because it was pretty controversial. We had run a photo of a young black girl playing with a bunch of other kids.
Like 5-ish, 6-ish.
Yeah, 5-6. Cute little kid. Mm-hmm. Darling little child.
And she had on these really colorful
leggings
that popped in the photo. Like,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, we run this photo of this girl playing at a Porter County school with other children as the lead photo with a story that we ran. I think a few days later, the photographer received a letter. The writer received a letter.
The writer received an email. Photographer received a handwritten letter.
Yeah, and the one that was handwritten was anonymous.
Right.
And it was to our photographer, a black man, John J. Watkins, accusing him of forwarding the black agenda.
Right.
An absolutely crazy letter to read right off the bat, that somebody would make that connection off of a photo of a little girl. Playing. The argument being Porter County is 90% white. Why aren't you highlighting the white children?
Yeah, there were 90 white kids in the background, but you focus on this black kid. And then added, I think it was the letter writer who added, we don't want a criminal element here.
We won't tolerate the criminals.
Like the Nixon silent majority bullcrap.
Yeah, and then the email that Joyce got. Joyce is our reporter. She is white. We mentioned John Jay is black. Joyce is white. She also got a letter, and said, you know, very horrible things in the email that she received. But you know, I want to point this out. You know, John Jay is accused of pushing a black agenda in that email or that letter. But John Jay didn't pick out the main photo.
No, it was a copy editor.
No, it was John Jay submitted. I believe there was like at least 10 photos
at least
submitted with that story that Joyce wrote. John Jay did not choose which photo went as the main photo. That was chosen by someone else. So,
he was just capturing moments at a certain time period, which was the only window he had to get art because everybody's busy and doing extra things nowadays. Mm-hmm. And
I think it says more about the person who wrote the letter that's what they saw in the photo, because a lot of our readers commented on our Facebook saying all they saw were children playing in the photo. So this is really more of a commentary on the letter and the email writers than it is about anything else.
Yeah, what was your impression, Krista, when you saw the letter and with the photo and the photo circled? And
yeah, I'm not a cynic, so I don't want to say people are getting worse and it's terrible and blah blah blah. But it just did kind of hurt me that in this day and age, people are still focused on this stuff. Especially, I mean, it's not even like it was a crime story. I don't even know how to dissect it or parse it anymore. It was a little kid. And I didn't even notice that she was either until they sent it. And it was like, I don't know, that's just kind of heartless and crazy.
Yeah.
And I just don't even, what is there even really to say about something so cuckoo?
Yeah, and our editor, Mark Chase, who has four children, two of them are black, and he wrote a column in response to the letter and email writers, and
it was angry.
Yes. And it was
well written too.
Yes,
yes,
very,
all done.
Very well written. And what was made me feel better about everything is once Mark's column came out, there was many, many readers who said thank you for addressing this and speaking out against this racism, blatant racism.
I'll say this. I don't work Sundays, and a lot of times I will just take a look at Facebook and see who's commenting, and if there's inappropriate comments, try and get rid of them. And I had warned the person who was going to be working Sunday, I said, this story's going up, this column by Mark. There might be some ugliness with this this post. There was zero.
No, it was all positive.
I have to say, I was pleasantly surprised by that. It made me think, this is isolated.
Well,
this is something that people, even if, let's say, this is what they think, they're certainly not going to attach their name and photo to
right.
it.
Right. Well, and that's what, like, the headline on Mark's column was, the worst kind of bigotry or prejudice is anonymous. You know, these people, the person who, there was initials on the email, but no name or, you know, address or anything like that. And then on the letter, there was no name at all and no return address on the envelope. So people feel emboldened to, you know, say these horrible things if, and they're not willing to put their name on it. So we can't even have a conversation with these people. So
and Mark particularly relished, though, because I think it was in the letter they said, show this to your editor. We're going to demand an audience. And Mark was like, my door is open. Come
right.
on
yeah.
in.
That's why he wrote the letter. Mr. Like, how are you supposed to address right. these people if they're not going to tell you how to contact them? So yeah. it's just, you know, if you're going to you want to be that racist and you want to be that hateful, put your name on it so that we at least can have a conversation.
Joseph, your impressions?
It was just really disturbing letter that we've kind of I was encouraged by the outpouring of support for John that he's received. He's almost like been abashed by it. To, like, people are treating him like, you know, like a loved one died or something. And like, how are you doing? How are you holding up? And it was like, you know, he's a tough seasoned photographer. He's been around. You know, people are capable of great ugliness and bigotry, and you know, he and everyone knows that. But it's just encouraging to see all the support he's gotten. And you know, we've like teased him a little bit afterward. There was the photo of the kissing couple in Crown Point. And it's like, well, why are you pushing a pro-statue agenda, John? Because it makes about as much sense as accusing him.
John has probably shot thousands of pictures of white people. I don't think he's ever received an angry letter from a black person saying, why are you pushing the white agenda? Yeah. You're a black man.
No. But imagine how much hate would have to be in your heart and how tarnished your soul would have to be to be so worked up about a picture of a little girl, like a small child, mortally offends you.
It seemed
to where you're going to spew vitriol.
It seemed almost cartoonish to read it. That this is that you almost
children
to the point of
be
being unbelievable.
Yeah,
like how really this one thing.
Although people were pointing, like forensic analysts online were pointing out that this was clearly like an older person though, because of the way like the ampersands were written, and it was on like three ring loose leaf paper, and it just kind of. The handwriting just kind of
as we've seen in like the past couple years, you know, I've noticed that there's a lot of racist remarks and actions, and they're not older people; they're people who are my age and younger, and they feel.
Oh no, it doesn't excuse.
We are in a little bit. I feel like we did take a step back. I feel like you know people are feeling more comfortable about saying horrible racist things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think. Bottom line, the ultimate sort of response to this turned this into almost a good story in a way because there was so much positivity and rejection of what this letter writer had to say.
Kind of like you know renewed our faith in the region because we had all these region you know readers coming out and backing us on our view of how this is a horrible thing.
We got a subscriber out of it, too. I saw one of the comments on Facebook said they were going to subscribe to our paper.
And now they definitely are, so it's good.
That's great.
Well, but we lost that one, sad. Darn it.
One
or
two.
You know, so we're still
giveth
even,
and taketh away.
Yeah. That's okay. That's all right.
Well, all right. We're going to move on to our next topic. This was a story that broke last week. All of the Carson's retail locations in the region are going to be closing along with everything else around the country for Bon-Ton, right? The Bon-Ton is the name of the company that runs Carson's. A lot of questions come to mind. Do we lose more than just the stores with these locations closing? What happens to region malls? What sort of impact do we suspect this is going to have on the economy? Joseph, you wrote about it. Let you lead off.
Well, in the era of Amazon, in which they're going to post like another record profit today, I think it's really been driving a nail in like department stores. The shift to online commerce. You've also seen migration toward big box stores. People are going to cheaper options like Walmart and Target, but online shopping has been eroding like retail across. But this is a significant, like this is pretty much...
It's a good thing we're giving them tax breaks then to move to our towns.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And while we pay them, the thing is like a lot of those warehouse workers, the average Amazon wage, the Seattle Times reported, is something like $26,000, $28,000. When you factor in all the, and that's not the wage that they're going to pay you at a warehouse. That's the average when you factor in all the headquarters employees who are like lawyers and other professionals who are making six figures.
Yikes.
Like so, they pay not very well, And also, they do not, they're not creating enough warehouse jobs to replace all the retail jobs that they're killing. It's not as evenly distributed throughout the country, and it doesn't pay as well. And it's not like, retail jobs are often like fallbacks for people. They get laid off, they go work at like, you know, a department store
students,
for a little
bit. Yeah, a lot students. Of kids at Purdue Northwest in Hammond were working part time at, you know, Carson's.
It's people's first job. It introduces them to work in the workforce, all kinds of things you need to know. But like,
my ladies at the makeup counter, the Lane Coleman Clinic, I'm going to miss them terribly. They were real class acts, and I just am very worried about them. Go ahead,
No, this is pretty much the death knell of the Woodmar Mall in Hammond. The three-story Carson's there was the last thing standing other than the sign.
It was kind of on its way out, though, already, right?
The Carson's is really popular there.
Was really one of their better-performing Carson's. It's hard to believe, but that was the only game in town. I live in Munster, and that was my go-to Carson's.
People came from Cal City.
Underwear,
from,
shower gifts, makeup. That was my
I've
store.
Never been to it. I'm really bummed out. I can't believe I've never been
it's
there.
It's worth going before it goes. That's where they used to have Santa in there.
When does it close officially?
It's like 90 days or... 10 to 12 weeks.
Yeah,
it depends how. Though it's going to vary by location on how fast they sell the stuff. Yeah. That's the.
Are we moving to a culture where we won't have malls anymore? That seems like now it's become something that is a 20th century idea that now in the 21st century is slowly fading.
They've only built one enclosed mall in the United States in the last 20 years.
That's amazing.
You see the Xanadu one in New Jersey, and it's a real over the top, like touristy one. But then they're still building the ones like Shops on Main, where it's kind of, it's a shopping mall, but it's more
outdoors.
Like a outdoors collection of strip malls. You can drive up closer to the thing. The shopping mall does seem to be out of a bit of an outdated concept, but they are like adapting. Like some places where they've torn down department stores, they've replaced it with these like lifestyle centers where they have like a bunch of restaurants instead, and they have like a full main street with fountains, and they might, on a Saturday night, they might have like a like small acoustic act come out and play, and they're trying to like modernize and embrace like changes in lifestyles and everything. But like this is also going to be really bad for the Marquette Mall in Michigan City, because they closed the interior of the mall like 2 years ago. It had already been like on all those dead mall websites because the inside was like ghastly and eerie and it looks really spectral, and it was like 90% empty. There was like a comic book store and like seniors walking day and like one record store, but everything's been driven out now. And then
because they have the outlets, they have the outlet mall in Michigan City, so everyone goes right to the outlet mall.
JCPenney just closed there, and then the only thing left is Sears. And with the rate that Sears has been closing across the country, and they've already sold off their Craftsman brand, and now they might sell off Kenmore to the CEO in his hedge fund company, which is not at all shady, after he did run the company into the ground and devalued it, buying up the assets for pennies on the dollar. Totally legit and above board. But they might sell that off. It's only a matter of time, honestly, before the Sears closes in Michigan City, and then there's like nothing left in that mall, basically. They have a couple like a Planet Fitness, and they basically converted an indoor shopping mall into basically like a glorified strip mall, where the only things there anymore are the stuff with frontage on Franklin Street and that highway. Like they made the only businesses in there are the ones like facing the parking lot.
I just think of like the teen culture of going to malls that existed for, I think, our entire generation.
Well, now they're encouraging teens not to even come
in. Right, now they're forbidding them.
Friday and Saturday, they got the broom.
I just thought about it now from what Krista said, but it's like that in a generation, that's really going to hurt them, because then teens aren't going to have any like positive associations with malls.
Yeah.
And when they're adults and they have all the spending power in society, then who's going to be the mall customers?
Yeah, like the term mall rat's going to be gone.
that movie is totally outdated.
I know.
And done.
I know. I love the smell of commerce in the morning.
Whole generation of kids who have
But
no
the thing
connection.
Is you know what's sad is they really encourage the death of malls, because all the stores do, because all their offers are for online purchases. They want to send you to online. They don't have to pay the retail workers in the mall. They want it, and they can pay them cheaper online, you know, workers online. And they'll give you incentives. You can go into the store and say, well, you know, your store gave me a incentive for online. Will you honor it in the store? Well, no, we can't do that.
It almost makes me curious if 10 to 20 years from now there'll be some sort of nostalgia The brick and mortar stores and the face-to-face interaction of going to a store. Like, once debt has died and then been a thing of the past, does it make a comeback?
Well, I have a friend, she does almost all of her shopping online, and she was like, it's so sad that all the brick and mortars are going to be gone. And I said, well, maybe shop in one of them once in a while. She's like, oh, no, I don't want to go into them.
I don't understand how people can buy everything online.
I don't know what the fabric
looks like.
I want to touch it.
I can't buy pants.
That's why they have a lot of reviews.
With my big fat Serbian butt, I got to try everything on. You just don't know if it's going to be flattering or make you look like a giant fat ass.
I go by the reviews.
It's a big gamble.
I'll go by the reviews.
I agree. Yeah. Like, although not the part about the butt, but everything else.
No, it's you're not insulting me. I need to see. I want to touch the fabric. I like looking in the sale bins.
Those are you're the kind of person that's going to be majorly bummed because there's
I'm
not
already
be
yeah. majorly
I,
bummed.
I have to say, if you like secondhand shopping, which I do, that's alive and well.
You know my feeling on that.
Well, the thing though too is that even though Amazon is now rivaling, if they haven't already surpassed Walmart as the largest retail company in the world, online still it's been fast growing, but it still only makes up a fraction of total retail sales. The problem is that people aren't doing like all their shopping online; they're just doing enough of their shopping online where the whole we built up all this retail for a certain amount of like demand, and now someone else is coming in and taking away enough demand where it's like what happened to newspapers.
But we can take a stand. Like, you know, I can buy my makeup and stuff at Amazon, but I prefer to go into Ulta because I want Ulta to be there. So yeah, maybe it's $2 more, but I don't know. Take a stand and start going into your stores and supporting the people who work there.
That and like local mom and pop shops. I try to go to them as much as I possibly can.
Yes, you do.
You know, I buy almost everything I own at Blue Pears.
Yeah, and like, it's all fabulous. Yeah, and you don't see those cute necklaces walking all over, you know.
Although the favorite necklace I own, I did buy online.
Yeah,
but everything else is pretty much Blue Pear from Crown Point. I'm a big fan of that. It's my grindhouse.
I'd rather order it at Miles Books than buy it on Amazon.
I try to shop.
Second and Charles.
Go ahead, sorry. Oh, no, sorry, my bad. But I was going to say, I try to shop local, but, like, online, the only generally times I'll do that is if, like, I've been to, like, four or five places and I can't find it, I'll just give up in frustration and see if I can, like...
Yeah. All right, that's a lot. Can I also say, in addition to Amazon, I hate hedge funds and hedge fund managers. And when I read in a magazine or see a TV show, and it's, you know, and they're portraying this hedge fund manager as this cool, rich, brilliant guy or gal, you know what? If that person accidentally got hit by a car and died in that next frame, I wouldn't be sad. That's how I feel about hedge fund
managers. That is bad karma.
No, they're the bane of our local economy. Those bottom feeders.
She's absolutely correct with hedge funds or with. With equity funds, like Toys R Us would still be around, but you have equity funds have bought a lot of these retails when they're struggling.
Yes.
They saddle them with a ton of debt, and then it's unsustainable for them to go on. Like, honestly, Carson's and Toys R Us could still be in business now.
Yes,
if
they could.
You know, there's
thank you.
Yeah.
All right, well, now that we've wished death to
I know, I was like, I don't wish death on anybody.
Executive.
Well, yeah, okay.
Only hedge fund managers said we're gonna move on to another topic. This one, another one that has got people stirred up, ICE officials came in to Highland earlier this week. I think it was on Tuesday.
Do you want to say what ICE stands for, the people who don't know?
Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
There you go.
There you go.
They were going to a site, a job site, for one man. I'm trying to think, somebody remind me why they were trying to pick him up. He had a warrant or something. Anyway, they were gone to pick up that one man. Turns out there were seven other men there who did not have documentation, arrested them all. There's been some immigrant advocates who have said that this was overstepping of bounds by ICE officials. Other people ask them, hey, if you're going to be here in the country illegally, that's the chance you take. If I shows up, hey, too bad. But these are people with families. They go to work, and then all of a sudden they just don't come home. And ICE will not even release the names to us. We requested the names, and they said that that is not their policy. So what do you think about. What do you make of this action by ICE? And this is something that, by the way, I've read a lot of stories. This is happening all over the country.
Joseph can speak more to this, but there's also, I know that Andrew Steele, I think it was Andrew Steele, our acting business editor, who wrote a series of stories. The construction unions and people here in Northwest Indiana, you know, it's a double-edged sword to them because they feel like some of the companies who hire these people pay them far less. They don't offer them protections because they know they're desperate and won't complain. And then meanwhile, legitimately trained, not yeah. just in their field, but also trained in safety and other precautions, who would command and deserve to command a higher salary, can't get hired because of this. So as with every sad thing, I'm sympathetic as well. If these people want to work hard and pay taxes and earn a living here, my heart goes out to them. But I know that there are always two stories.
Yeah, we have not got the identification, I believe, on the contractor yet.
Right, right.
That
no,
has not been,
yeah.
not been made available. You think arresting, taking these people away, who deserves the more punitive punishment? The contractor?
Right. Good point.
The people that are coming into work.
I don't think it's black and white. I think there, like, you know, we said there's two sides to this story, and there's not a black and white. There's not an easy answer for that one, for me anyway.
Mm-hmm. One of the advocates said if these people spoke English, if they weren't Latino, would somebody be asking for their papers? A legitimate question. Let's say they were Russian.
Or Polish.
Or Serbian. Are they going to be treated differently? Who knows?
Who knows? Yeah, it's a good point.
Yeah, I'd sympathize with the workers in the sense that, like, I really hope that somebody's communicating with their families, and unless they're hiding themselves, trying to not get mm-hmm. found by ICE, and that there's some sort of.
I do too. And whatever economy they came from, clearly they're here because they want to work. And whatever economy they came from, they can't work. And, you know, they want a better life. They wouldn't be here doing that.
I know
otherwise.
That this story did very well on our website. So I know it is a topic. And
hot button topic.
Yeah, very to our readers. So, you know, and we are going to have an update on this story this week. Our reporters are currently working on it to get an update. So, people listening, make sure you check at NWI.com and the Times itself for an update on this.
And to hear more of these That's So Region podcasts, you can go online to NWITimes.com. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks very much to our reporters, Dan Carden with the Times of Northwest Indiana and Carol Carlson from the Post Tribune. And thanks to the reporters and staff at the Times of the That's So Region podcast, Matthew Schubert, Carrie Erickson, Joseph Pete, and Krista Zivanovich. And that's it for Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte. We'll be back with you on Monday.